My name is Kenneth. I am a member of State Students Advocating Freedom and Equality, a GBSU's, or GBSU's student organization whose primary focus is LGBT liberation movement for equality. So we fight for freedom and equality for all people. Victoria Law is a writer, photographer, and a mother. After a brief stint as a teenage armed robber, she became involved in prison support. In 1996, she started helping Books Through Bars, a New York group that sends free books to women in prison, drawing attention to their issues by writing articles and giving public presentations. Since 2002, she has worked with women incarcerated nationwide to produce Tenacious, arts and writing from women in prisons, and has felt capable of having incarcerated women's writings published in her larger publications, such as Clara Magazine, the website Women in Prison, a site for resistance, and the Makeshift Magazine. Her book, Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles for Incarcerated Women, is the accumulation over 7 years from listening, writing about, and supporting incarcerated women nationwide, and resulting in this form of eloquent writing and winning the 2009 PASS Prevention for a Safer Society Award. And I would like to open this with Victoria Law.
Hey everybody, thanks for having me and thank you for having us. So before I start my presentation, I wanted to ask two quick questions. By a show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Attica Prison Uprising? Show of hands. Okay. And by a show of hands, how many of you have heard of the August Rebellion? Okay. So for those of you who don't know or you know need your memory refreshed, the Attica Rebellion or the Attica Uprising happened at a maximum security men's prison in New York State called Attica in September of 1971. The guards there were tired of the intolerable living and working conditions, and they wanted to be treated like human beings and not like animals or something less than animals. They issued a series of demands for reform, and they took 38 staff members hostage and held portions of the prison for 4 days. They asked then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller to come and negotiate with them about these demands for reform, and instead, Rockefeller sent in the National Guard, who fired tear gas into the prison yard where many of the prisoners and their staff member hostages were standing, and then fired live ammunition indiscriminately into the yard, killing 31 prisoners and 9 guards and injuring hundreds of more people. However, the Attica Rebellion also served to capture the attention of many people on the left, so people who were struggling for black liberation, student liberation, Chicano liberation, women's liberation, people working around housing, around education, around all sorts of other social justice issues, sat up and took notice of what the people inside Attica were saying, what they were demanding, and saw that they needed to start connecting the issues that they were struggling for on the outside with the issues that the people inside prison were facing, and that they weren't all that different. So this was seen by many as the start of the prisoner rights movement, or the start of the 1970s prisoners' rights movement. 3 years later, at the maximum security women's prison called Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in New York, 5 male guards beat a prisoner organizer named Carol Crooks and placed her in solitary confinement without a hearing. The month before that, Carol Crooks had actually won a court injunction stating that the prison was not allowed to place women in solitary confinement without a hearing. They actually had to be charged with something. They had to have to go before a disciplinary committee. They had the right to defend themselves against these charges. Basically, they had the right to due process before they were placed in a box without any human contact. So clearly, this was retaliation for Carol Crooks' victory. And the story might have ended there, except the women around her said, you know what? We've had enough of this brutality. They're not going to get away with it this time. And the women around her protested Carol Crooks' beating, and they took over portions of the prison and held 7 staff members hostage. And they held the prison until the state called in male state troopers and guards from neighboring male prisons to come and retake the prison. In the course of the retaking, 25 women were injured, and 24 women were subsequently transferred to the Mateo 1 complex for the criminally insane without any of the required hearings. And I bring up these two rebellions because they happened during the 1970s, one of which seemed to be the kickoff for the 1970s prisoners' rights movement, and the other one that happened 3 years later when people on the left, people on the outside, were paying attention to what happened in prisons, were in contact with prisoner organizers, and were connecting the struggles inside and out. However, as you can see by the show of hands, while many people remember Attica, and it's been documented extensively with books, literature, articles, in conversations, in movies, the August Rebellion doesn't even garner a footnote or a mention in any of these conversations. And I bring this up to say that if we're not recognizing and remembering these very visible riots and rebellions, is it any surprise then that we're not recognizing less visible forms of organizing and resistance in women's prisons? I want to pause from talking at you to just, you know, ask for a couple of minutes, what do you think about when you think about women in prison? What issues come to mind? Just call them out, if you will.
Anything?
HIV. Women in prison are more likely to be HIV positive than either men in prison or women on the outside. And that's and if you look at the ways in which people at the very bottom of the economic ladder survive, it's usually by a way that if they were given a choice, they wouldn't. So this could mean sex work, this could mean drug dealing, this could mean any number of things, but the ways in which women scrape by to survive often put them at greater risk for HIV, AIDS, and other STDs than men who end up in prison. Other issues?
I can see like women getting taken more like advantage of in relationships because there's won't be able to protect themselves. Like a guard has like some kind of like hidden agenda against them. I feel like they'd be able to protect themselves less.
There's a huge lack of protection from staff misconduct and staff brutality in prisons. When you think about prisons, you have to remember that the people who are guarding you have total control over like what you eat, when you eat, whether you're who gets you hot or cold, whether they put you in a solitary confinement, which is literally locking you in a cell for 23 and a half to 24 hours a day without human contact. So it's basically having your entire life circumscribed. Other things that come to mind?
Pregnancy.
About 5 to 7% of women enter prisons and local jails pregnant each year, and most jails and prisons don't have capacity to deal with pregnancies in prison. Other issues?
Emotional support.
Many people in prison find support. So I'm focusing on women in prison because it's not an issue that people necessarily look at a lot, but it's not to say that like men in prison are living the high life. This is not what I want to convey, but I'm saying that if men get next to nothing, women get less than nothing from outside society. Other issues?
Healthcare.
Healthcare in men's and women's prisons is atrocious, but when you think about the fact that prisons were designed with men in mind, there was never any consideration given to the specific healthcare needs that women face, like pregnancy, like breast and cervical cancer, like having regular gynecological exams. Other issues?
Sexual abuse.
Sexual abuse is huge in prisons. It's huge in men's prisons. It's huge in women's prisons. In 2003, President Bush signed the Prison Rape Elimination Act under this guise that prisoners were assaulting each other and raping each other. And the first investigation that they did found that really the majority of sexual assaults in prison happen because staff members assault the people that they're paid to guard. And in women's prisons, it's also huge because in 1964, the Civil Rights Act prohibited gender discrimination in employment. So that meant that women could work in men's prisons, and it also meant that men could work in women's prisons. And this was with no consideration as to where these men would be working. So men could then watch women in their sleeping areas, or in their shower areas, or in the toilet areas, dressing and undressing and doing everything that they do in their daily lives as part of their job. And because we're in Michigan, I looked up a couple of not-so-fun facts about sexual assault in Michigan prisons. And Michigan prisons have an alarming rate of sexual assault inside its women's prisons. In 1993, the Michigan Women's Commission reported that there was an alarming level of sexual abuse and harassment by state prison guards towards women in prison. In 1995, the U.S. Department of Justice found pervasive sexual abuse in Michigan women's prisons and filed a lawsuit the next year about it. And in 1996, Human Rights Watch released a report documenting that there was pervasive sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and privacy violations by guards and other employees in Michigan's prisons. Other issues that come to mind? One other thing I wanted to emphasize, because it seems like it's the elephant in the room a lot of times, is that women of color are the fastest growing population in prisons. And women of color are disproportionately in prisons compared to the numbers on the outside. A recent study found that 149 of every 100,000 black women are in prison, compared to 50 of every 100,000 white women and 75 of every 100,000 Latino women. And this is not because black women commit more crimes, but because of racism and racial profiling. There was a study by the Department of Justice that found that African Americans and Latinas are 3 times more likely than white people to be searched, arrested, threatened, or subdued with force when they're stopped by the police. And a study in 2008 found that the arrest rate in California was 49 out of every 1,000 black girls were arrested, versus 8.9 of every 1,000 white girls and 14.9 per every 1,000 Latina girls. So if you look at the way that our society polices people and who they see as criminals and people to be monitored, you'll see that people of color, and when you're talking about women's prisons, women of color are the ones that are surveyed, monitored, and punished. This is also to say, and also, alternatives to incarceration more often are granted to white defendants than to people of color when they end up in the court system. Now that I've thrown all these horrifying facts at you, I wanted to talk about some of the ways in which women in prison have been resisting and organizing to challenge these conditions. So they have not been sitting on their hands. And since I'm in Michigan, I wanted to talk about some of the efforts that women incarcerated in Michigan have been doing. We talked about the pervasive sexual harassment and sexual abuse in women's prisons in Michigan. And women have filed individual lawsuits challenging this and gaining results from this. But also in 1996, 31 women incarcerated in Michigan filed a lawsuit, Nunn versus MDOC, or Michigan Department of Corrections, for being subjected to various degrees of sexual assault, sexual harassment, violation of their privacy rights, physical threats and assaults on their person, and retaliation by employees of the prison system. So basically, if a woman reported that she had been sexually assaulted or sexually abused, she would be subject to retaliation not only from the person she reported, but by all that person's coworkers as well. The next year, the district court ruled that a person's right to bodily integrity and privacy do survive incarceration. Basically, what the court ruled was that a person in prison still has the right to not be assaulted, even though they are in prison. And in 2000, MDOC signed a settlement agreement limiting housing unit staff to female officers, which meant that only women could work in the housing units, and banning cross-gender pat-down searches, which meant that men were no longer allowed to put their hands on women under the guise of searching them, which had been going on until that time. In 1996, 500 women who were incarcerated and formerly incarcerated in Michigan filed a class action lawsuit against guards and the prison system called Neal versus the Michigan Department of Corrections. And the case wasn't settled until 2009 because court cases move slowly. And as part of the settlement, male guards were prohibited from entering areas in which women would be partially or fully undressed, like their sleeping areas, their shower areas, and their toilet areas. And the courts ordered the Michigan Department of Corrections to pay a $100 million settlement to the more than 900 women who had been sexually abused inside the prisons from March 1993 to July 2009. So the 900 or so women who came forward as part of this lawsuit were all offered settlement money. Unless you think, like, well, this, you know, like, they're after it for the money, or, you know, like, what good is money? One of the ways in which you can get prison systems or police systems or any sort of institution that has the capacity to abuse people to check itself is to actually make them open up their wallets and pay for the abuse. And it's a way that they don't like doing, you know, they don't like doing that. And superiors are more likely to rein in horrific abuses if they realize that they're going to be made to pay for it. Going back a little bit, still in Michigan, in 1973, women imprisoned in Michigan filed a lawsuit because Michigan was one of the few states that provided basic education programs only to men and not to women. So if a man went to prison, he was able to get his GED, get a college diploma, maybe get some sort of skill, and when a woman went to prison, she was able to take maybe her GED and something like crocheting or how to make your own personal calendar, but nothing that would prepare her for being able to get a job and be able to survive without doing anything illegal when she was released. So one woman went to prison and said, I want to go to college. You know, I want to be able to do something with my life when I get out. Realized that that wasn't the case and filed a lawsuit called Glover versus Johnson, which claimed that prison officials were violating their rights under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. In 1979, the court ruled in their favor and ordered that the prison set up an education program similar to the one that they were organizing for men. And the court also ordered that the prison provide a course on legal skills to the women because they said the only way that prison abuses can be remedied is through the courts. Now, I disagree with that. I think that there are many different ways you can remedy prison abuses, but this is what the court said. And because women didn't have the necessary skills to be able to sue the prison needed to provide them with legal courses so that they could file more lawsuits and make sure that the prisons were treating them humanely. So this was a landmark ruling, and it's not something that people necessarily think about when they think about prisons, when they think about prison resistance and prison organizing, but these are things that women have done. And some of these women, including Mary Glover, who filed this case, took these courses and then went on to file other suits against the prison system, including Neal versus MDOC and Nunn versus MDOC, which I just talked about. And although I talked about women's lawsuits extensively, because that's what I know about what's been going on in Michigan, women have also resisted in numerous other ways to challenge and change the abuses they face at great risk to themselves. Because remember that even though they're filing lawsuits, it's not like they go home at the end of the day and they're safe in their house. They go back to the prison at the end of the day. And then there they have to face the same guards and the same staff members that they just filed a lawsuit against. And these are people that hold the keys to their cells and can decide what they are and are not allowed to do and how well or how not well they'll be able to live. For instance, Mary Glover, who was the person who filed Glover versus Johnson and many other suits, ended up spending an additional 7 years in prison because staff members were pissed that she had filed lawsuits and won them. And so they issued her misconduct tickets, or disciplinary tickets, basically saying, like, you know, like, you didn't have a pass to stand under a tree, or you shouldn't have been going to the bathroom at this time, or your shoelace is untied, or your shirt is untied. And when she went before the parole board said, you have all these tickets. You obviously aren't ready to get out. And she spent 7 additional years because she stood up for herself and for the women around her. So that's something to keep in mind when you think about the fact that people in prison, women in prison, other people in prison are fighting, is that they're doing so often at great risk to themselves and to their freedom. And I wanted to end by urging you to make connections between the issues that you're working on and the issues that are going on inside prisons. So if you're working on education issues, you don't necessarily need to take on prison issues as a whole different issue, but see where they intersect. You know, look into what the educational programs are like in prison. Look at the fact that people in prison often go there because they don't have the same educational opportunities as people who don't go to prison. And see where you can make those connections. And then just expand your discussion and maybe some of your actions to incorporate that. So it doesn't need to be a whole different subject. If you're talking about housing or you're talking about LGBT rights, look at what people in prison are facing around those issues as well. And I wanted to end with a quote from a woman who is currently incarcerated, who when I asked her, what do you think people on the outside can do to support people on the inside resisting, she said, I was thinking about how we prisoners are very cut off from much of the rest of the world, including people who do not support the prison system or people who may be interested in our struggle. So I think that more communication via letters would help. I think that transaction would encourage resistance on both ends because it would strengthen information and knowledge both ways. I also think that hearing about efforts of resistance outside of prison would inspire and encourage us prisoners. Plus, through correspondence, people can see that many of the incidents they read or hear about happen daily, and it will really legitimize things. The communication between two humans concerning their hopes, ideas, and their plights is what allows them to bond in resistance against a system that affects everyone in many different ways. As I mentioned, we prisoners would be inspired to see another position of struggle and that though they may differ, all struggles are shared. This would strengthen resistance both inside and outside of the prison gates. Thank you. Well, I might want to step to the side. So if you can't see my face, just raise your hand and I'll step to the side. You know, I'm kind of short. My name is Molly Barton. I am the chapter president of Amnesty International at Arizona State University. Amnesty is the largest grassroots organization for human rights. We work to promote and protect human rights across the globe. We have, about 3 million members across about 60 countries. And we work with all human rights abuses, from people unlawfully in prison to the genocide in Darfur to LGBT issues to anything you can think of that might be considered a human rights violation, we deal with it. And one of the biggest campaigns that we have is to abolish the death penalty. Amnesty has a very strong campaign against ending the death penalty. And we were all very excited a few weeks ago when Illinois governor finally signed the bill to end the death penalty. Everyone's very excited because he's from Chicago. So that's one of our biggest campaigns, and we have a couple of case issues that we deal very closely with, and one of them is Troy Davis's case. Troy Davis was arrested in 1991 for murdering a cop. There were 9 people who said that he did, and he's been on death row ever since. A few years ago, it came out that 7 of the 9 witnesses wanted to recant their statements because either they didn't think that they got all the information correct or that the police pressured them to say that Troy was guilty. One of the 2 who did not want to recant their statements is someone who could be the potential suspect of the actual murder. So, go figure, he's not going to want to recant his statement. We finally, I think it was about last summer, got him an evidentiary hearing. And about, they said no, it was going to go to the appeals. And about 2 or 3 days ago, we found out that the appeal was denied. And so it's very likely that within the next 2 weeks, he will have a new execution date and or may be executed. So this is something we've worked with very closely for a very long time. I know myself as well as many of our members, including Randy, are all, we all have our I Am Troy Davis shirts because we don't know whether or not he is guilty. There was no gun, there is no material, like weapon, any sort of evidence towards it. And what I like to tell people when I'm just kind of introducing the topic is basically that he was proven, he was guilty until proven innocent rather than innocent until proven guilty. And it's no surprise that he is an African-American male living in the South. So as Victoria said, there's a lot of racism in the prison system. And so we do have a petition in the back at our table that if anyone is willing to sign, we'll sign it. We will get those letters out by the end of the week, and hopefully we can get another stay of execution, another appeal, hopefully, because now we're just hoping that he has a fair trial, because whether or not he's innocent or not, everyone deserves a fair trial. Which leads me into our next speaker. Our next speaker is Mark Clement. He served in prison for 28 years as a juvenile who was sentenced to life in prison, and now he is an administrator for the campaign to end the death penalty. So, Mark Clement.
Good evening. As she basically touched upon Troy Davis' case, Troy is allegedly guilty of killing a Georgia police officer. 9 witnesses, 7 recant. An individual by the name of Red Coles. There is enough evidence against him that could probably indict everyone in this room. What most people feel about the criminal justice system is that it plays unfair. If you are poor, a lot of people fail to realize that poor, I didn't put a color with that. If you are poor and you are charged with a serious crime, chances are that you will be found innocent is very rare. Chances that if Mr. Troy Davis was not found guilty of a very serious offense, such as a police officer, Troy would probably be walking among us today. But because a policeman is dead, and because police play dirty tricks and trades and games, there's an innocent man that is indeed about to be executed. What most people fail to realize is this. We are a nation of people that believe in the law and corrections. We are a nation of people who have allowed a government to send children to prison. I was 16 years of age. Very serious crime occurred on the city of Chicago South Side. Four people died in an arson fire. Well, there was a commander on the South Side of Chicago. His name was John Burge. What John Burge did was, when crimes occurred in the African American community, he would round up African Americans and take them down to the police station. And in the manner as to how they were tortured, notice I'm not using that word brutality, because if I grab you in your genitals or your testicles, trust me, every man in this room will tell you that's torture. Some men had electrical shock boxes connected to their testicles. This shock box was plugged into the wall. We have a criminal justice system that has the nerves to say, well, if you didn't commit the crime, why would you confess? This is what needs to change. Being 16 years old, I was sentenced to 4 natural life sentences, plus 30 years. That means I supposed to have died and woke up somehow 4 different times, and then I would still have 30 years to serve. What the criminal justice system failed to look at is the real perpetrator. And that was because I was labeled as the perpetrator. Here was a confession that was taken by a 16-year-old, no parent present. They said that this confession was voluntarily given. Told the court the best way that I could at that particular time that the police grabbed a wee-wee in this question. It wasn't Caucasians who most people would say, well, hey, he must have had a Caucasian judge. No, it was an African-American. And what they did, they laughed. That's what they think about your children. That's what they think about your future children. To laugh. So you're paying a system to protect you, and the system laughs. 4 people dead. They should have taken it very serious that 4 people were dead, but they didn't care. One of the reasons that they did not care was due to the fact that here it is, a confession, no witnesses against me, no visible evidence linking me to this crime. They said that they had 2 bottles with my fingerprints on. These bottles turned out to be the fingerprints of the police. They said that I stabbed someone and that I beat them. Me and 4 other individuals, but I was the only person charged. Well, the coroner stated that he found no evidence of blunt trauma. Furthermore, he stated that he didn't even find a stab wound. And to really kind of like tip things off, these were adults adults. What can a kid do who's taken to a police station? What can a kid do who is now faced with spending the rest of their life in prison? First of all, kids don't know nothing about no criminal justice system. That's what we all must wake up and wise up and understand. I was painted to be a monster. You know, someone who seeks revenge against someone and burns down a whole building. But these were facts that were ignored. And it was ignored due to the fact that I was poor. 1981, yes, they took the color of your skin. And they used that against you back in 1981. Today we're dealing with economic racism. So you have many people, they're sitting around and they're saying, well, hey, I'm the wrong color. Well, I beg to differ. Because Illinois prisons, I was released in August of 2009. They're filling up with Caucasians, with every race. And there's a reason why. It's because people have let their guards down. Anytime a parent sits back and believes the criminal justice system more so than their children, that's why we're dealing with these problems. Children that are even out committing crimes. Our system says that they should never be shown a second opportunity. Well, I differ with that. Michigan may be the first state which has abolished the death penalty. The very first. But it ignores the fact that it wants to keep children in prison who allegedly commit crimes at the age of 13 years old. So I can be a kid at 13 years old and maybe because we do something foolish, I'm locked up for, I'm talking about the rest of my life. And if people in this auditorium think that's a joke, I know some men who've been locked up 40 years. There were children who were locked up at very young ages, 13 and 14 years old. If these men are released back into society today, no jobs, can't get no health care, people looking at you funny and crazy. Our society lost its love. That's why people like Troy Davis is suffering in Georgia. Because people don't have no love. I can sit here and I can fall and I can talk about this stuff till I drop dead. It's up to each and every one of you to receive my message, take it home, and to apply it. Our streets shouldn't be silenced. This is a problem that primarily affects African Americans. These little tiny legs walk all over, trying to get the word out. And when we tell you, a lot of people missing the message. And that's because they don't care until they become a victim of the criminal justice system. It's time to get involved. Being 16 years old, locked inside of a small closet interrogation room, now walking and telling a judge what occurred to me, and that was my genitals was grabbed and they were squeezed. Hey, any of you in this room could have been victims of John Burge. And if you don't know who John Burge is, go Google that name. Because the man really made history. He literally picked nearly 200 African Americans off the street, not at one time. His victims is probably greater than even what Hitler did. A lot of people ain't catching on. John Murray was Russian. He walked the city of Chicago, and when these crimes occurred, he literally would round up 50 and 60 men, throw them in cages, beat them, and whoever was the one that confessed, that was your crime. That's what John Burroughs did. Now, when you consider all the murders and all the crimes that he investigated, you tell me that the victims of John Burroughs amounts to 200 people. No. A lot of people are embarrassed to come forward because some of these men had metal rods stuck in their anus. That's what happened. The death penalty in Illinois should have been abolished many years ago because it was unfair. It was shown that what John Burroughs did, he didn't just beat guilty suspects. He beat innocent suspects. He framed them. And with our criminal justice system, rather than to give the men hearing, you still got 22 men still locked up in prison as a result of John Burroughs' tortures. All of them has served at least 20 years in prison. Now, no computer experience. No job training. Now you release these men back to society and you tell these men, hey, guess what? Achieve. That has to be the biggest insult that I ever heard in my life. Because if I take any of you and I lock you in a room for 20 years of your life inside your own house, all you have is a telephone, which I let you use once a week, and you can watch TV. And I'll feed you three times a day. Now I release you after 20 years. That's the problem that you're dealing with. As Michelle Alexander best describes in her book, The New Jim Crow, think about it. You got men, they suffer physical and mentally, can't get no help. The mayor of the city of Chicago right now was the one who put everything together. People voted him in office over 20 years. Over 20 years. And it's not even a secret what he did. He was the state's attorney, so he covered up the beats to get to convictions. So he used those convictions to come before your nice fellow Americans. I'm a great, honorable man. I have locked all these criminals up. And people went out and they voted for this man in droves. They're remaining to vote for this man in record numbers. He has decided not to run, so now we do have a new mayor that will take effect shortly. But would this have occurred? Would these men still be in prison if they were rich? No. Why in the world does it take over $3.5 million to free me out of a prison when everything was right there from the get-go? All it took was adults owning up to their responsibility that they failed a kid. That's our problem now today. Michigan ain't heard the last of me. Because there's one young man in prison here in Michigan, and he's been locked up over 20 years. James Charms, as she explained about the rapes, I know James personally. He was corrupt in the state of Illinois. The state of Michigan hired him. It was sex rings in these prisons. People walked around and they ignored these women. They doing it now today. It's just being sugarcoated. The white prison in Illinois, going on every day. The stuff being sugarcoated. And every one of you in this room can make a difference. I urge that everyone in this room, is any one of you, sign that petition for Troy Davis. His sister Martina, she has cancer. She's been surviving for 10 long years. When the people said, as a matter of fact, make it 11. They said she's supposed to have been dead 11 years ago. And she's been holding on to see her brother released. Think about that. Sign that petition. Give this man an opportunity. If racism stands up in our way, we are supposed to be the mighty force to blow it back the other way. If we don't do our duty, how is the criminal justice system going to listen to us? There's a young man, when I was here last year, he was shot in Detroit, Michigan. I don't hear nothing even about that story no more. Because it blew over. Please, think about that. Help Troy. Help end Chicago police tortures as well. Thank you.
And I am a member of the International Socialist Club here on campus. And I'm going to introduce our third speaker. Her name is Randy Jones. And she has been fighting injustice for a little over 10 years now. Most of the time she has been fighting the Texas death penalty, where she worked with the case of Kenneth Foster, who was issued a last minute commutation by Governor Rick Perry. Randy, along with other people, worked side by side with Kenneth's family, trying to put together press conferences, protests, rallies, petition drives, and educational events to save his life. Last September, Randy moved from Texas to Chicago, where she is now on the International Committee for the Campaign and the Death Penalty, and she is also a member of the International Socialist Organization.
So I want to start by saying how happy I am that Illinois has now joined you, fine Michigan folks, in abolishing the death penalty. It did take us a little bit longer than it took you. I don't know if people know that history, that you guys abolished yours in 1846. The first English-speaking government to abolish the death penalty, so kudos to you. As Furman mentioned, I moved recently from Texas to Chicago, where the current governor, Rick Perry, has overseen 226 executions just himself. Of course, that doesn't include the Bush years that came before him. So there's still a lot of work to be done on the national abolition front. So I hope we'll all get involved in taking on that work. But abolition in Illinois is certainly a step in the right direction, and that's where I want to start today. I want to talk about what it took to win abolition in Illinois. Because it wasn't the case that, you know, the legislators woke up one morning and decided that state-sponsored murder was a bad thing. It was because of years of public pressure, years of activism, people speaking up from inside of prisons, activists taking their words out to the community. And that's how abolition was won. It took family members of those prisoners, like Mark's mother, Virginia Clements, coming out to rallies and speaking out on behalf of her son, as a lot of the mothers did, as Martina Correa does for Troy Davis. It took educational events, press conferences, and as a result of those things, the governor at the time, George Ryan, pardoned 4 men who had been tortured by police, the same police commander who oversaw Mark's torture. And then commuted the death sentences of 167 men. Since then, Illinois had enjoyed a moratorium, and now we finally, at long last, won abolition. And it's all because of ordinary people like us standing up to that system. And I just want to say that the struggle for justice continues. As Mark mentioned, John Burge recently went to prison, which I think is another step in the right direction. Unfortunately, he's only in prison for 4.5 years, but I still think that's significant, because if we look at what our society does, police and politicians seem to get away with whatever they want to, while millions of poor Americans are ushered into prison walls. So abolishing the Illinois death penalty took a grassroots movement, and I think that's what it's going to take everywhere. And I think we can go back to our history books, and we can talk to our elders, and we can learn how that's done. We can look to the civil rights era, how people in the South were organizing, how they organized bus boycotts, lunch counter sit-ins, and they kept up the fight even when things got hard. And they looked to pull in new people, they mixed educational events with agitational events, and they never ever gave up. And I believe that struggle for fairness in the criminal justice system today is part of that same fight for civil rights in the 60s. And we should stand proudly in that tradition, and we should study that tradition. So I'm going to come back to the title of what this event is, which is Lethal Injustice, Standing Up to the Death Penalty and Harsh Punishment. And I think lethal injustice means a lot of things. Of course, it means the death penalty. But I think it also means the horrific conditions that the other speakers talked about in which prisoners live. Many of the prisoners in the United States spend 23 hours out of their day inside their cells. A lot of the work programs and education programs that once existed have been gutted. In Texas, prisoners get 1 5-minute phone call every 6 months. Medical care inside of prisons is oftentimes horrendous. Recently, there was a pregnant woman who died while in police custody because she didn't get proper medical treatment during complications of pregnancy, and that's horrific. That is lethal injustice. What happens to people after they're released from prison is lethal injustice. In many states, once you have a felony record, you're not eligible to vote. So what that means, what that actually looks like statistically, is in Alabama, 33% of African American men there aren't eligible to vote. And that's insane. And once you get out of prison, in a lot of ways, you become a second-class citizen. You're not eligible for government assistance for food stamps or housing. Healthcare, that is lethal injustice. The fact that Texas wants to execute a man so mentally ill that he gouged out both of his eyeballs and ate one of them, instead of treating him for the mental health care problems that he has, is lethal injustice. The sheer rates of incarceration in this country are lethal injustice. The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And that's a pretty recent phenomenon. That's happening. In the last 3 decades, that rate has skyrocketed. And people should, and Mark mentioned Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. If you haven't checked that out, you really should, because it's amazing. It's about, like, she goes into depth about the drug war and what that meant for the rates of incarceration in this country and who that drug war targeted, which was people of color. And if we wanted to get back to those levels of incarceration that we had in the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people in prison. The fact that the majority of exonerated inmates do not get financially compensated upon their release is lethal injustice. In some cases, these men spend decades of their lives behind bars for crimes they did not commit and are released without ever seeing a dime. Then they have a difficult time finding housing, jobs, health care. Mark has had some of those struggles too, and he can talk to you about that in the discussion period. Lethal injustice to me is about racism in this system. Why are African Americans 40% of those who are locked up, even though they only make up 12% of the population? And mandatory minimum sentences are legal and just. There are people serving life sentences in this country for the sale of marijuana. That's insane. So when I talk, Troy Davis has been mentioned, and I think that's so important because I think the fight to abolish the death penalty is a crucial part of fighting racism in our society. It is the sharpest edge of the criminal justice system. It's the thing that you can't take back. And I've often heard the criminal justice system compared to an iceberg, which I kind of like that analogy. Because in this analogy, the death penalty is the very tip of the iceberg. And then it's like once you hit that iceberg, you realize that it has a massive base underneath. And I feel like once you start the work, and some of the people in Amnesty can probably attest to this, once you get organized and you start realizing, you start fighting the death penalty, and then you realize all of what's underneath, all of the rates of incarceration, the conditions, all of these things that are part of that same iceberg. So Mark and the speaker from Amnesty talks about Troy Davis' case, and I think his case is so important because it illustrates the problems that so many cases have. Racism, the inability for poor people to receive proper representation, corrupt prosecutors, faulty eyewitness testimony, and all of these things result in innocent people being put to death. Martina Correa has been mentioned several times tonight, and I don't think anybody can speak about her brother's case as well as she can. So I'm actually going to read to you a statement that she issued today, because I think it's so important to get her voice out to you. So here it is. On March 28, 2011, I woke up elated about my 10-year anniversary as a cancer survivor. I looked outside and it was cold and gloomy. The sun was nowhere to be found. It's about 9:30 a.m. and the phone rings. It's my brother Troy Davis's lawyer, and from the tone in his voice, I knew it was not good news. My heart sank to a heavy place as I listened to his monotone voice saying, "We just received news that the United States Supreme Court has denied Troy's appeal." Knowing that the appeals for Troy have always been an uphill battle, and the lawyers have always stated that from a legal standpoint, yet today I also heard optimism in this statement, "We will seek and exhaust all legal means available to us." I know from a legal standpoint, denial by the Supreme Court is nothing a lawyer finds optimism in, yet I felt the readiness for yet another battle. My first concern was my mother and my brother Troy. I cannot imagine facing three execution dates and the possibility of a fourth. I knew Troy would be more concerned about our family than himself, but I also knew that as much faith and spirituality as my mother has, she's still a mother, and we are fighting for my brother's very existence. In this fight, Troy is no longer voiceless, and my family is no longer invisible, yet the court still refuses to hear what we have to say. Innocence does matter, and beyond a reasonable doubt should be of utmost importance. One thing for certain is that the global concern about this case is growing, and yet the highest court in the United States is not willing to address the issue of innocence and new evidence. We live in a country that is supposed to promote democracy and human rights for other countries, yet it is not unconstitutional for us to execute innocent people in the United States if the courts feel they received a fair trial. I am both enraged and empowered, for this battle to save Troy is a war of life and death for me. Until there is no breath left in my body, I will fight for Troy, fight against the injustice of the death penalty, because this battle is bigger than Troy. It is a war against a system that is not impartial, a system that cares less for fairness and more for finality. In no way have we ever diminished the loss and hurt of the McPhail family, yet both families have been victimized. Being a mother and having stage 4 cancer, I understand the importance of life, and I'm willing to give my life to spare my brothers. No matter the final outcome of this case, my war against the death penalty is far from over, and I will no longer be victimized by this system in the United States that justice depends on your ability to pay for it. The hearing held in June 2010 in Savannah was like a puppet show. It was entertaining to some, upsetting to others. Yet once the judge opened his mouth and looked at my brother with disgust, I knew that no matter what Troy's lawyers had to present, the judge had already made his decision to deny Troy. So he was just going through the motions like a puppeteer. I saluted the witnesses, even though they were criminalized by the state prosecutor for recanting their trial testimony. When they testified against Troy all those years ago, the police treated them like heroes, even though they had the same criminal history in 1989. It also seems amazing that all the police who testified had amnesia about their role of misconduct with witnesses, yet the judge chose to believe them over recanted testimony of the very witnesses they used to secure a conviction and death sentence for my brother. The Georgia Parole Board said they will not execute when there is doubt. The case of Troy Anthony Davis is full of doubt. As Troy said to me, it's not over till God says it's over. This fight for justice did not begin with me and will not end with me. The battle for justice and the war to save Troy wages on. My name is Martina Correa, and I am on death row because that is where my brother lives. Our lives intertwine. If Troy is executed, he will become even more powerful because people all around the world are saying, I am Troy Davis, and his story will be heard. And just to say about that, his story will be heard dependent on what those of us in this room do. It's not a foregone conclusion that he'll be executed or that he won't be executed. That completely hinges on the things that ordinary people, like you and I, the things that we do. So you should sign a petition. We should also, and we can talk about in discussion ways that we can help save his life, actions that we could organize even on this campus that could make a difference in getting the word out, getting his name out. So I just, on that note, you know, people have been paying attention to what's going on in the news. The world is changing. Things are different. People are beginning to realize their power and stand up. We saw in Tunisia, we saw in Egypt, that people were able to stand up and overthrow their brutal dictators. And I think that we can do those same things with the criminal justice system. That fight has now spread across the Middle East. And of course, it's complex and it's changing. But we've seen also people start to fight back against the budget cuts in this country and the austerity measures that both the Republicans and Democrats want to push through. I'm sure a few of you, well maybe, went to Wisconsin during some of the protests that were going there. I had the pleasure of going up there a couple times. And there were huge protests there, and those protests were against, they were for the right to continue to be in unions and to collectively bargain. The governor there is trying to slash healthcare. Those things are related to our fight for reforming the criminal justice system. It's all about the mixed up priorities of this system. And I just wanted to say those priorities are putting, they put corporations, the rich, they give massive bailouts to these banks, huge bonuses to executives, spend billions on war, and then look to balance the budget on the backs of teachers and public workers. And what we have to say is, we want education instead of prisons. We want healthcare instead of prisons. We're linked with those educators who are standing up in Wisconsin. That's our fight too. I think what we have to say is, the priorities are messed up. We know the things that would help prevent violent crime if the system was actually interested in doing that. Those things are healthcare, education, access to quality mental health care, housing, after school programs. These are the things that would prevent violent crime, not massive rates of incarceration. And we want to live in a society that has its priorities straight. But we can't rely on politicians to hand that to us because they won't do it. We have to fight for it. We have to fight for Rodney Reed and Troy Davis and Mumia Abu-Jamal and Kevin Cooper and so many other people. We have to continue to give the death penalty a human face. These people, Mark said that they make him feel like a monster. They tried to make him look like a monster, and we know that that's not true. There are prisoners right now in Ohio who are, they want, after they're executed, to donate their organs so that something good happens with their bodies after they're executed by the state. And the state's not letting them do that. And we have to, I mean, we don't want them to be executed, but we do think that they have the right to give back in that way. We have to fight for financial compensation for the men who have been released. We have to fight for an end to the drug war, which incarcerated so many people of color. And we have to remind people that life without the possibility of parole is an in-house death sentence. And the same problems that apply to the death penalty, the same problems that apply to life without parole are the same problems in the death penalty. Racism, it punishes the poor who can't afford adequate defense. It sometimes gets it wrong and convicts innocent people. Those problems still exist in life without parole. And we have to remember that the fight against the death penalty is just the tip of the iceberg. It's hard work, but I think things are moving in the right direction. Death sentences are dropping. State by state, the death penalty is being called into question. The debate over lethal injection and the scramble to find the perfect drug cocktail to kill healthy people is showing that there is no right way to do the wrong thing. And more broadly, we've seen the fight back in this country, and I talked a little bit about that. We have to link those struggles together. The fight for LGBT liberation, the fight against racism, the fight for quality education and affordable health care, the fight against wars, the fight for equal rights for women, the fight against the prison industrial complex, these are all linked together. That's why I'm a socialist. I see these problems as linked to the larger problem of a society that puts profit over people. And changing that is going to take a fight, but I actually think that people organizing on a grassroots level is the only way that we're going to win that fight, and I think our side can win it. So I encourage you guys to get involved in whatever way you can to carry that fight, whether it's doing LGBT work. And I think that what you said was really important about finding a way to link the struggles together, finding a way, if you're doing education work, find a way to talk about the prison system. So yeah, there's lots of things I think that we should talk about in the discussion about what we can actually do about these things, because it is definitely a grim topic, but I think that there's hope, and it's all dependent on what people like us do.
Okay, so it looks like we have a little bit over 40 minutes for Q&A, questions, comments. So I'm going to ask people to kind of form a line up here. The questions could be directed at our speaker, to the floor, to all the people in the room. But we'll take a few questions first, and then we'll hand it over to the speakers, and then we'll come back and finish with the rest of the people that have questions. So without further ado, if people want to start coming up to the mic,
I forget your name on the end.
Vicky.
Vicky? Mm-hmm. Okay. You have a lot of statistics about African American and Hispanic or Latino and whites in the prison system, but you didn't mention the Asian population. And I was just wondering if you have any statistics.
I don't. That's why I don't. Like, it seems like Asians and in many states Native Americans are not considered enough to be counted, or I don't know what the rationale is for not even being like, there's like one in, you know, however many thousands of people we lock up who are of this ethnicity, but I haven't found any.
Okay.
Sorry.
How you doing?
Hey.
Okay, I have three questions. The first question is, could you all mention how did you get involved in what you're doing now? For those who would like to get involved, I really don't know the outreach side of how to do that. Secondly, how do I get a I Am Troy Davis t-shirt? And thirdly, I just have a comment. You challenged us to do something, and I'm all for doing a freeze mob just to raise awareness on the struggles that you discussed today. So my name is Marisa Sparks, and again, freeze mob, I'm all for it. I'll help work the street with you. So thank you.
So I guess I have a question for Randy specifically. So what was some of the work actually like in Texas, and like how does Texas actually compare to the rest of the US when it comes to executions? I know you kind of spoke a little bit about it, but I mean, it seems like where, I guess, are the just like speak a little bit more about your work in Texas, and maybe, I don't know if you spent a long time in Chicago yet, but how does it compare to like work in Chicago?
Do you want to come back right now?
Yeah, sure. Anyone else? Any questions?
Comments?
Well, the pace of work in Chicago is a lot different than it is in Texas, obviously. You know, in Texas, sometimes there would be 3 executions a week. They've done them 2 in one night before. So the pace of work is a lot different, and I think a lot of the model that we used there was the same thing that people were doing in Illinois, and we were sort of inspired by that, where it's like the people, first of all, who are in prison, their voices are so important to get out there, and putting a human face on those people is really, really important. That these people aren't monsters. They have families, they have friends, people who love them. Some of them are guilty, some of them made a mistake, but that mistake shouldn't be the thing that that encompasses all of who they are. So I think that's one of the things that we always try to do is put out, you know, put their family members, put their own voices at the forefront of our struggle and try to get those voices out there. And then a lot of the work was educational events, things like this, where, you know, you talk about the Texas death penalty and how horrific it is and then all of the problems that go along with that. And then a lot of, you know, we did protests every time there was an execution, and sometimes you only have 10 people out there sort of bearing witness to the fact that Texas is executing a person. You know, it's easy when the rate of executions is that high, people don't even think about it, they kind of forget about it. So it's important to kind of bring it out and say, like, somebody is being murdered tonight in your name. So that's some of the stuff. And then the work around Kenneth Foster, I think, was really important for us. Because there's always, for years, there was a sense of, like, we do this work because it's the right work to do, and I think that that's true. But what we learned in the case, struggling around Kenneth Foster's case, is that we also can win, and we did in that case. That the petitions, the educational events, the press conferences, getting letters from all over the world, that stuff does make a difference. And in Kenneth Foster's case, it did make a difference. We were able to shut down the Texas death penalty, which is something that had never been done before. So.
In our age of neoliberalism, privatization has become the new norm. I was just wondering if any of you would like to speak on how privatized prisons have changed it for the worse.
What, how the privatizing of prisons have changed the conditions, or, well, privatized prisons have greatly changed, because with each and every prison that is built, they got to fill them up.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what they do to fill them up. That means they create ridiculous laws. They lock up any and everyone for any crime. And that is the sad reality that most people and, you know, fail to realize, is that when these prisons are built, hey, there's a wave in arrest. And many people start going to prison for crimes that they were not going to prison. Just look at and then consider one, for instance, under the Reagan administration, when they begin to create this war on drugs, and they shut down all of the drug rehabilitation centers, and you know where their new home was? Prison. So that's one thing that people need to understand. Yes, it created jobs for some people. And I will say that very strongly, for some. You politically vote in particular politicians in particular areas where that these prisons are built, yeah, you get a job. If you don't vote for them, no, you don't get no job. It's just as simple as that. Now, one thing that I would like to ask each and every one of you here, this is a newsletter, and it is called The New Abolition. Matter of fact, I have an article in here about Chicago police tortures. We are one of the only organizations who send money to prisoners, who accept phone calls from prisoners, and this stuff is expensive. This newsletter is only 50 cents. Would you please purchase one of these newsletters before you leave? If you really look at it, 50 cents, most of you drink 2-3 cups of coffee a day from Starbucks. See? So think about the guys that really need your help. Also consider joining the campaign to end the death penalty. And consider becoming to be a monthly sustainer. Monthly sustainer, if you can just donate $5 a month. Think about that. Five little measly bucks a month. We go through, shoot, $15, $20, $30 and one meal. But we cannot support organizations that are trying to support our families and our friends. Please think about that. And it's up to the universities. Because, believe it or not, the civil rights movement would not have been a civil rights movement if the colleges didn't get involved. There was two aspects of the civil rights movement that allowed it to really take off. The churches and the universities. So think about that.
Before you speak, can I just piggyback onto the private prison question? Is that also prisons are a business, but private prisons are set up as a business. So the thing that matters is the profit that they make. Mm-hmm. They have shareholders. The shareholders want to know how the prisons are doing. So you get X number of bodies. So you get 100 bodies, and you get paid $2 per person per day. How do you make the most profit out of that? You start cutting the food. You don't hire unionized guards. You skimp on guard training. You know, like, you basically do everything that you can to not spend money on those people that you're getting paid to warehouse. So the atrocities that happen inside government-run prisons are even more prevalent and horrific in privately-run prisons because there's also no oversight. So think of that that way, too, is it kind of changes the nature of looking at prisons as big business, with people actually investing money into this. And going back into a historical context, when slavery was first abolished, there was something called the Black Codes that were set up in former slave states that basically criminalized actions only if the person committing them was black. If you stood on the three people stood on a corner, bam, you all got sent to jail. You know, and then you were sent to go work in a convict labor camp. And there were private corporations that came and contracted with the local jail to have these people come and work for them for nothing. So basically they replaced slave labor. And the private contractors were able to say, hey, you know, this person didn't work hard enough or they talked back or whatever, so we're going to add an extra 10 days to your sentence. We're going to add an extra week to your sentence. And it was a perpetuation of, you know, using slave labor. So if you kind of look at the privatization of prisons, you'll see that there is, you know, a historical precedent for that, of using people and using incarceration not only to control certain populations and take them off the streets, but also as a means of profit for certain industries.
Hi, this fall I thought there was a really good question I asked earlier. One place you can get an I Am Troy Davis t-shirt is Amnesty's online store at AIUSA.org, but I also have questions. So in my mind, there are three main arguments for the death penalty. The first is that it brings closure. These are the arguments, not necessarily saying they're true, but closure for the victim's family, that is less expensive, and that it's a deterrent for further crime. So I'm wondering if the three of you, probably it seems like a question more directed to Randy, maybe, but three of you could talk about how you respond to those arguments.
Are we taking a few questions? I'm sorry. Are we taking a few questions and going back?
I think that's a good question. I can't
Okay.
So I think that's a really great question, and also thank you for the answering the Tori Davis shirt question, because I think everybody should get one of these. The first thing, closure. If you look at, you know, it doesn't provide closure for the families, and for one thing, well, because they have to continue to go to these appeals processes and relive that story, and the prosecutors really play up those stories, the horrific details of the crime, and the family has to sit there and relive that all the time. And then, you know, there's a lot of groups who organize, who are family members of murder victims, who organize against the death penalty, because what they found is that, you know, if it takes an average of 13 years to kill somebody, to execute somebody, then that family is just waiting around, waiting for this closure. Then once the execution happens, they don't feel that because they haven't been healing. You know, they've been waiting for that moment. And then just to say also on that issue of closure, you know, not every murder crime, the perpetrator gets the death penalty. So what it's saying is this loved one is more important than this one, and it sets up this arbitrary, you know, where these people deserve closure, but these people don't, or whatever. And so I just think it doesn't provide that. And then the idea of it being less expensive, well, there's actually, it's not, that's not factually true, because of the appeals process. Not that I think that we should take that away. I think to me, it's like the expense. I think we could look at the expense that we spend on the war. We could look at the expense that we spend on giving banks bailouts and that kind of stuff, and find ways to fund, you know, life imprisonment. Well, I'm not actually an advocate of life imprisonment, but we could find ways that would rehabilitate people and use our money in a different way. But right now, as it stands, the death penalty is not more expensive. Is not less expensive. It's actually more expensive. So just that. And then the idea of it being a deterrent to violent crime is actually, no studies show that is true. And if you look at the people who are committing these violent crimes, it's usually either out of desperation, where you need something to survive, out of like a crime of passion, where you walk in and find your lover in bed with somebody else and you kill them or whatever, or it's because of a severe mental illness. And in none of those instances can the individual have an idea that if I do this, if I commit this murder, they don't have the foresight to think about those things happening. So it's not true that the death penalty is a deterrent to violent crime.
Can I add one more thing? You asked, the first thing you asked was about closure. When I was 20, a friend of mine got stabbed and died. And it was like a long, horrific dying process. He stayed in the hospital for 4 months in a coma. The person who stabbed him, you know, was arrested after he died. You know, like, everybody knew who did it. The person was white. The person was rich. So he wasn't even indicted the first go-around. And then when my friend died, he was rearrested, indicted. The whole process, and New York doesn't have the death penalty, so he wasn't, you know, under threat of death penalty, but the whole process did not provide closure for his partner, for his family, for all of his friends. We camped out in that hospital room for 4 months and watched him die. Going to that courtroom to see this guy, you know, who had taken away our loved one, did not provide closure. Mm-hmm. There were no other services or supports for anybody who had been affected by this. They did not ask us, like, you know, what do you need? Do you need grief counseling? Do you need, you know, like, what do you need to heal from this? You know, and what can this person provide? It was like, this is what the law says, you know, you need, is you need this person to be hauled up in front of court. You need him to smear your friend's name as a justification as to why this happened. You need there to be a back and forth argument. There is no concern about what the people who are most affected by this harm mm-hmm. actually need. So, you know, to, like, argue that this provides closure, you know, I'd say no, because even in a case when the other person's life is not at stake, it didn't provide any sense of closure for any of us.
I'm glad the Brett brought up the point of private prisons, because I'm extremely concerned about the profit motive being involved in the incarceration of people.
Mm-hmm.
One thing in particular that I wanted to note was a rather astute NPR story a while back regarding SB 1070. As it turned out, some of the main actors involved in the construction of the bill were actually private prison corporations that wanted to open new prisons in Arizona, specifically to house women and children who could be arrested under the law that wasn't even like introduced yet, but they knew that it was going to come up for a vote, and they knew that it was going to be passed, and that they were going to be able to make a profit off it. I just wanted to make that comment. If you guys could elaborate any more, feel free.
I was just wondering, if there was one thing someone can do to help get involved, what would you recommend? If just one thing.
Well, I guess I think that depends on your skill set and what people want to do. Because I know, like, people who make movies, who make documentaries, there's some amazing stuff out there, and that's important. People who are... I like the detail organizing stuff or whatever, that's kind of like my bag. So that's the kind of stuff I want to do, work with an organization doing that kind of stuff. I think like on this one thing I think would be great, I actually think that you guys in this room should organize this, is on this college campus to do a speak out about Troy Davis, to do a tabling with petitions for him. There's been things in the past where people have like held up a picture of his face to their face, saying, "I am Troy Davis, this could happen to me, it could happen to you." I think that kind of stuff is like one simple thing. Like, can people in this room organize a freeze mob? Is that what you...
Flash mob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like things like that. Like what, you know, thinking creatively, like what can we do? How can we get the word out? What can I send this email about Troy Davis out to 10 of my friends today? Can I send this... I think there's a lot of stuff. So I guess that was more than one thing, I apologize.
I did a research paper for my English class on the juvenile prison system, and what I'm seeing is that the juvenile prisons are being built like adult prisons. I see men, young boys, 15 or 16 years old, being locked in a shower with bars on it, being waited to be sent into a segregation cell. You speak of being locked up as a juvenile. Have you realized that the juvenile prisons are becoming like adults?
Well, first of all, I've been an activist since 1985. Yes. This was something that was spearheaded under the Reagan administration way back. It's just people are now just now catching on to the realization of what Reagan, Bush, what's the other guy, Clinton, and yeah, Clinton, the horn player, he really messed some stuff up. See, and the other Bush. So that means we had over two decades of bad policymakers out of Washington, D.C., focused towards prisons. There's no rehabilitation and no juvenile centers, what they call them, juvenile detention centers. they run them that way, knowing basically, if they, what they say, if they rattle your feather, you get upset, you get mad, you strike out on them, and, you know, maybe if they was going to prison for a year, now they assault the guard, now they go for 10 years. See, so the system is designed this way. When I first entered prison, they had every rehabilitative opportunity available. Today, when we tell you, when I see kids allegedly committing these crimes and they get arrested, it almost make you want to cry. Because when we tell you, they have totally nothing. Mm-hmm. These men can't drive, they can't vote, And guess what? You go to prison at 13 years old, get natural life in prison, never been with a woman. Think about that. They never had the opportunity to be with a mate. Think about that. So now these young men, they go to prison, and when they come out of these prisons, messed up in the head.
I don't know. I guess this would be a question more directed towards Mark. But would you say that the way the prison system is set up is like set up so that like people will return? Is that so? That's kind of. It sounds like they're set up for failure to come back into mm-hmm. society. But does that mean that? Like, how is it even helping?
The criminal justice system. Craftly came out with ways to create men to return. If they don't give you a job, they don't teach you anything about no jobs, what you think gonna happen? And put it this way, put you in jail for just 1 year. We ain't got to lock you up forever. For 1 year. That means a year and 1 day. That's what constitutes a year according to the states. Now, I lock you up that time. Now, when you get out, your family won't help you. That's many of the problems that these men face. Now, they can't find no job. Now, you hungry. What you gonna do to survive? Think about it.
I guess I just wanted to make a comment. So, capital punishment in the U.S., as we see, doesn't really have anything to do with justice or being a deterrent of crime or protecting us from the public. I actually see it as a political tool for those who are rich and powerful as a means to reinforcing racial, I guess, divisions, and it actually diverts attention away from the social and economic problems and pins the blame on a rather like abnormal case rather than on taking up the real social conditions at hand. And I think right now we are beginning to live in a period where we see those socio and economic conditions come to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And they're coming to our forefront because they're affecting us, they are affecting us directly. We see that Rick Snyder is trying to cut education by 22%. We see that unions are under attack. We see that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans people do not have their rights. And so I think we are living in a period where those conditions are actually becoming more and more vibrant in a way that it's like a reality for a lot of us. And so I think we have to look at this period as not just a period of attacks, not just a period of oppression and exploitation, but like the speaker spoke to, also a period of resistance, also a period where people like us who may not think that we can be part of change, people like us who may not think that we can be part of history, are actually beginning to stand up, come together, and fight back. And we see that that fight back is happening in Wisconsin, and we hear that it's actually, and we see that it's actually happening here in the capital of Michigan. And so people all over are beginning to see that they have the potential to change the current system, and that it won't be the politicians who wake up one day and say that today is the day that I had a great cup of coffee and today's the day I'm going to pass the bill, but that it really will take the work of us here in this room. But think again, we're beginning to see the reemergence of class struggle from below, something that people that have been involved in the movement have been hoping, but not just hoping, actually preparing for these things, right? We actually have to understand that you can only contain and push back the exploiting of the press for so long before it explodes and it gives way to resistance. So we actually have to be looking at how we are situated today, historically, in a period where we do see the reemergence of class struggle. We need to look at that, and we need to realize that the skills, leadership, to wage a successful struggle happen inside of struggle itself. And as much as you want to be outside of the struggle,
you don't actually wage a successful struggle from the outside. But you, if you want to lead, you have to join and you have to be on the inside. So finish with that.
I just like to say, there is one name I haven't heard, and I do want to put it out there for everyone. If you don't know his name, I encourage you to look him up. And also, I kind of have a question for Anna Skinner. I actually know if they're working with his case. Leonard Peltier, I guess he has opinions on that, but I just want to put that out there for everyone.
Do you want to explain that for a little about his case?
He's a Native American man. I don't remember the year or anything, but he was accused of killing two FBI agents in a shootout. Well, first of all, it was a shootout, so it was chaotic anyway. There's really no proof that he did it. But it's been proven that the FBI actually fabricated the evidence held against him to lock him up for life. It's also been proven the FBI coerced testimony, so there's false testimony against him. And the list goes on. It's just huge. That's why I encourage you to look it up, because there's a website dedicated to it and everything. So, Leonard Peltier.
I just have one more question and a statement. You speak of men coming out. I know Lauren, he did this from the age of 16, and I know that she just came out and succeeded. And I think a lot of, do you focus on women? And before you answer that, I have a statement to make. I think a lot of people that need to support prisoners need to give them the strength and the stability to that when they do come out, they succeed. I just did 12 years. I've come out and I'm succeeding because of women like Victoria Law, who wrote me since 2001 and told me how strong I was and how much that people out here care about us on the inside. So it's important that you guys give the prisoners support mentally. They need it.
Thank you very much for your thoughts. I actually came late because of a Facebook announcement that was wrong, but I still was happy to hear some of it. So I have kind of an announcement and then also a question for you all about the campaign to end the death penalty and how you talk about it, because I have some frustrations with it, I guess. But I first just wanted to say that I work with an organization called the Prison Creative Arts Project, and we're based in Ann Arbor, and we work in prisons and youth facilities mostly around Ann Arbor. It's about an hour to an hour and a half away. And I don't want to take too much time, but I just wanted to offer the thought that if you are interested in working in facilities and haven't done it yet, I think that's one of the best ways to actually learn how to fight against it, is to bear witness and be with folks. It's not teaching classes, it's going in and facilitating workshops together. So even if you don't consider yourself an artist, I would encourage you to think about it. And then I'm also really interested in knowing if there's work like this being done already in this area, in Muskegon and Ionia, where there are a lot of prisons, and I would love to talk to anybody here that's doing the work already. So I just want to throw that out. And a question that I have about the death penalty is, one of the frustrations I have is that I think it makes sense for people to say we're putting the wrong people on death row, like we could kill an innocent person. So right away, folks are like, okay, maybe we shouldn't put people on death row. Maybe we should just put them in prison then. And then they always have the chance of, you know, being found innocent. When I think the larger question is, who are we incarcerating? Mm-hmm. Why prisons? Why do they look like they do? And I know you all have spoken to this tonight, but I think it's difficult in talking about the issue to get people to think about anything bigger than just putting the wrong person on death row. Just like right now, you know, the conversation about reducing prison populations is around the budget, and as soon as the budget is fine, as soon as we have a little bit more money, then it won't be a concern. So I just wanted to throw that out and see how you guys respond to that.
Well, let me tell you, and Randy can contest to this. First of all, I don't believe in natural life sentences at all. Okay? So whoever told you that, they told you completely wrong. I am a board member, okay? Administrator too. And let me tell you, anytime I hear anybody mention that, and there are some groups, I'm not going to mention no names, but when I heard it, I completely brought to the other board members and made a recommendation that we disassociate ourselves from them. I was a kid, locked up, given 4 natural life sentences. Now I have an opportunity to make a difference, and I'm going to support putting anybody in prison? No, sir. I think you need to Google the name, Mark Clements.
I wasn't personally saying that you said that. In general, people have, I just feel like people
the campaign to end the death penalty do not support any natural life sentences for anyone.
I agree with, as far as the, Mark's right, we don't. But I think that your concern is a completely valid one, and it actually is a problem within the abolitionist community. A lot of groups and organizations aren't willing to confront issues of race, for example, or class. They just want to talk about it from a moral perspective, and they do put forward life without parole as an alternative. And while the campaigns in the death penalty were a single issue group, we do want to talk. You know, I feel like I've been going on and on about Michelle Alexander's book, but I think it's so important. I think it really is the new Jim Crow, just opening up that conversation. And I actually feel like the death penalty, like talking about the death penalty, is a way to talk about prisons in general. It's a way where you can get in and say, like, yeah, that we can agree that the death penalty is terrible, but what do you think about the racism of Troy Davis? And then you talk about, other cases. Well, this exists within the system as a whole. And then I think that there is a conversation. I've been in the CDP in Austin, Texas. We did a study group about Angela Davis's book, Are Prisons Obsolete, where we are talking about, like, do we need prisons? Is this the best way for us to separate members of society? And then also I feel like our organization does a pretty good job about talking about the real causes of crime instead of just ignoring that. And I think that was said by somebody. You know, that's what the death penalty is about. That it's about, like, locking away. We are, and the entire prison system, we're locking this away. We're putting it over here. We don't want to talk about these mentally ill people. We don't want to look at these faces. We don't even want to open up that conversation. I think what we all want to do is say, like, no, we do want to talk about that. We do want to address mental illness. We do want to talk about poverty and what that creates, and that it makes people commit crimes, and we want to solve those problems with a real, honest look at the root of them. So I agree with your concern about the focusing only on the death penalty, and I think that conversation has to be much, much broader.
Yeah, first, thanks everybody for coming to speak. It was really great. I want to comment about these things kind of on a local sphere if you want to get involved. Over in Muskegon at the county jail, actually, they just passed a policy, and this is a policy that's been either, like, considered or adopted at other counties throughout Michigan. It's a policy that they eliminate all communication with the outside except for postcards. So you don't have packages, you don't have letters, you just have a standardized postcard, and that's it. This is a policy that was just adopted, I think, in February. And so there's been a lot of organizing being done around that to try and get that policy reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're interested in wanting to take action against that, next Tuesday over in Muskegon, we're going to be having a rally, and then we're going to be addressing the commissioners at the commissioner meeting after that. So hopefully you can get the sheriff to listen to us. And if you want more information about that, I have a ton of flyers. I probably gave you one on the way in. Or just come and find me afterwards. I can give you some more info. Also about, like, carpooling over from Grand Rapids would be totally cool too.
Are there any more questions? Because we left one unanswered, and I feel really bad.
We're going to take the last round of questions. So if anybody else has a question, just raise your hand. No? Okay, guess we'll...
Oh, hold on for a minute, because we never answered the sister's question over there. She asked first. And then and then like, you know, like we just kind of like kept going, so I'd feel kind of bad. So you asked like how we all got involved with what we're doing.
You go first.
Okay, I guess I'm going to go first. All right, I will try to keep it short. So in my as my bio mentioned, as a teenager, I was involved in some of the Chinatown gangs in New York City, got arrested for armed robbery. There were several factors working in my favor. You've seen that I'm not very big. I don't look very threatening. I'm not black. I'm not Latina. I'm not the usual suspect for, you know, a violent felony. And I got straight A's in school, and the judge looked at me and said, okay, you know, obviously you're not like the usual candidate for like getting sent to prison. My co-defendant, however, who had several prior felonies, got a lengthy prison sentence. I got probation, but that was the start of me starting to get involved with prison issues. Like, my friends were going to jail, then to prison. We were all going to high schools that were now, that would now be considered school to prison pipeline schools, where the schools are so bad, it's like you're prepping people for prison. Like, my high school had 4,000 kids. My graduating class was 40, you know. We were all black, brown, immigrant. We went through metal detectors. You know, most of the teachers didn't care whether or not we were there. And again, I think because I was smart in that academic way, the teachers paid more attention to me, and they were like, hey, wait a minute, you know, you actually can do something more than just hang out on the front stoop and, like, smoke cigarettes and drink 40s and smoke pot all the time. Like, you need to be doing something more with your life. So after a lot of my friends got locked up, I started getting involved in prisoner support work through visiting them, through keeping in touch with them, through corresponding with them. And then I started looking at some of the systematic literature that systematically dismantled, like, who goes to prison and why. And all of my experiences backed up what they're saying. You go to the visiting room. In New York City, we have something called Rikers Island, which is an island devoted solely to pretrial detention for people who can't afford bail. Like, we can't afford good schools, but we afford a freaking island, you know, to lock people up before they even go to court. So you sit there in the waiting room, and you wait, and you wait, and you look around, and you see that it's all poor people. There's no, like, Bernie Madoff's wife or whatever, like, sitting in the waiting room next to you. You know, it's all poor people. It's mostly people of color. It's mostly people who've committed either a drug crime or a crime of survival. Like, they're trying to get by somehow, you know. And this was reinforced by everything that I read. So fast forward a few years later, and I was in college, and I decided that I was going to do a paper on post-Attica prison organizing and resistance. And I was like, okay, what's been going on since, you know, the 1970s? Like, what does prison resistance look like now that we don't have all these liberation movements, now that COINTELPRO and the FBI have dismantled all these things? And at the end of the semester, I looked at everything I had researched and was like, this is all men. You know, what's going on here? Why am I not seeing anything about women resisting? So I said, okay, let me start by throwing everything I think of about prison issues out the window and start looking at what's going on inside women's prisons. And what I realized is that if you look at prison issues as a bookshelf, you see that, like, everything is, even if it's gender neutral, it's focusing on male issues, which kind of makes sense considering that the majority of people locked up in this country are still men. But then at the very bottom shelf in that corner are the issues that specifically impact women. Like, the fact that over 80% of women in prison are mothers to children under the age of 18. You know, the fact that women in prison more often experience abuse before they're incarcerated and continue to be abused while they're incarcerated. The fact that women have special health needs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all down there in that corner, and they're not integrated into the larger conversations we have when we talk about incarceration. So I started looking into, like, well, you know, what are these issues? And then if we're not looking at these as prison issues, then we're not looking at these actions as the actions that women take as prisoner resistance or organizing. And I started reaching out to various women that I started hearing about. That's how I met Kebby. That's how I met, like, you know, a dozen other women who are all like, hey, there's something going on here, and this is what I'm doing. Like, I'm not sitting on my hands. There can't be 100,000 women being abused and facing these atrocities all sitting on their hands, you know. And that's when I realized that resistance, when you're facing different issues, you know, it looks very different than what we typically think of resistance and organizing. So that's sort of my, like, small nutshell explanation.
Mine is not that interesting, I feel like. I was in college, a freshman in college, and the war had just started, the war on Iraq. And I was really upset about that. And I was like, I can't just not do anything anymore. So I actually wanted to get involved in anti-war organizing. But I saw a flyer for an anti-death penalty event instead, and so I went to that, which is actually kind of a funny story because I ended up going to the wrong room, and it was a sorority, and I was very confused about what I was doing there. But anyway, so I've been doing it ever since, and I did want to, I'm so glad that you're here, and that story of you guys corresponding I think is really so amazing and beautiful. And just to say, like, our, the campaign on the death penalty, this is something Mark and I have been talking about for months now. We actually want to, I was telling Vicky at dinner, like, we want to be more involved, because it is true. It's like, I mean, every single pronoun in here is like he and men, and that is something that we want to take up. We've tried to correspond with some women with not very much success, so like, that's definitely something that that our movement needs to address, for sure. So I'm really glad that you're both here tonight. Your story is obvious.
Well, I basically got involved basically in activism in 1985, dealing with a young child who was 15 years old. She was sentenced to the death penalty in Indiana when the statute required you being 18 years or older. The judge told this African-American young lady, Paula Cooper, that he could not see himself sentencing a African-American, well, he didn't say African-American back then. Back then, he was known as blacks. A black to prison for anything less than the death penalty for killing a white Bible school teacher. So, I, you know, this young child, guilty of sin. But should the law be ignored and denied to allow her to be executed? She's not executed. She's still in prison. I pray one day that she will get out of prison due to the fact that it should be a cut-on time in dealing with prisons, and it should be a cut-off time. That's the problem now today with most of society. It's called revenge. The same way prison officials do when they carry out an execution. They seek revenge. They sit around the prison, they drink alcohol, they jump up, they shout. You know, these are the stories that you'll never be told. I was there. I witnessed it. So, I've been involved since 1985 with activism. I have been a member of the campaign to end the death penalty since 2002. And you know, hey, it's all about fighting for the things that affect you most in life. And that's what I choose to do. Thank you.
I just want to thank everybody so much for coming. We really appreciate that you guys came out, the speakers as well, making the trip out here. Just a couple quick reminders, they do have that newsletter up at the table back there. Victoria's book is also back there for if you'd like to purchase it. And most of you, if not all of you, are getting the evaluation as you walked in. We would really appreciate the feedback for future events, and you can just drop it off at the table back there. And have a good night. Rest easy.